Hello, and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Ingery, a senior writer at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by fellow senior writer Sarah Carlin Smith and executive editor Nielsen Hobbs. Today is March 22nd, 2024. We usually don't hear a lot about the FDA and the U.S. Supreme Court, but this week we have two cases to discuss. The first is on a familiar topic, mifepristone. Sarah, you previewed the oral argument in that case. What should we expect when the court convenes?
So at this point, there are actually two cases that have kind of been consolidated, sort of challenging FDA's approval of mifepristone. At this point, the drug's approval is not so much at stake, but really the safety updates FDA has made over time to kind of loosen the REMS, the risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. So these things have made the drug a lot more accessible to people via different modes of access. They've also made it possible to use it later in pregnancy. So I think that's kind of like the key thing the court is going to be looking at. But then, you know, it just, the case sort of brings up these broader concerns really about when or if judges sort of have the authority to overrule, you know, the agency's scientific judgment and decision making.
And then you also saw some polling that a group had done, you know, kind of leading into the oral arguments here coming up. Those seem to have some interesting numbers just about public sentiment in the case.
Yeah. So, A group that is, you know, very supportive of, I think, access to the abortion pill. So, you know, always like a caveat when, you know, groups like that kind of commission polling, you sometimes have to take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, they commissioned some polling that was conducted by sort of a combo of like a progressive firm and a Republican consultant that to try and get a sense of just it sort of gives you a broader sense of kind of how the public thinks about FDA decisions, and then also sort of more keyed in on mifepristone. And I mean, basically, broadly, you know, it seems like the public does trust the FDA to determine a medicine is safe, but it does skew a little bit by political affiliation. So while like 80% of Democrats, you know, trust FDA determine a medicine is safe, that drops down to 52% of Republicans. And, you know, that's still a majority, but it's a smaller one. And then on some of the like more abortion specific questions, when they ask, you know, if mifepristone is safe, you know, again, you get overall the public, the majority says it's safe, but then if you break it down into, you know, subgroups, the Republicans group drops below 50% to like 39%. Similarly, you know, one of the things that's going on in this case, you know, they polled about whether it should be okay to mail abortion pills to people in states where, you know, the state law has, you know, sort of made abortion or certain types of abortion illegal. And again, you know, like the overwhelming majority of Americans as a whole say yes, but it's skewed a bit by the much higher percentage of Democrats and independents who agree with that versus Republicans. Again, it's only a minority. So, you know, I thought it was interesting. We don't tend to see a lot of polling about, you know, what the public thinks about the FDA or knows about the FDA. And I actually had stumbled across some polling from KFF last May, so almost a year ago, where I think they were also sort of motivated by what was going on with mifepristone to do some of this polling. And they didn't ask quite the same questions, but you did end up actually getting like, they're similar enough, and you get again that sort of the same sense that, like, you know, the public has pretty high confidence levels in the FDA overall, but it does start to drop a bit, you know, Democrats, you know, have a much higher favorability view than independents, than Republicans. And they also just even tried to gauge in that poll, like, public's awareness, right, of the abortion pill, of mifepristone. You know, and they were starting to see, again, you know, awareness was on the rise, which, you know, makes sense given the publicity that's been given to this topic over the past year or two.
I don't know. Maybe I'm misreading the numbers, but I mean, when I looked at the overall 65% trust the FDA to determine a medicine is safe, I thought that was low. I don't know. Maybe I'm just totally misreading the American public over the years. But I would think if you're FDA, you want that number probably up in the 80s. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm just, you know, my aspirations are too high, but it seems like, you know, maybe some of these issues with the pandemic and all the, you know, social media misinformation, all this stuff we've talked about over and over again over the last 4 years, you know, is fueling, you know, that kind of stuff.
That's a great point, Derek. That number for Democrats is 80%. And, you know, if you think about net promoter scores and all those sorts of things, that, you know, that's sort of just at the threshold of sort of kind of what you'd think of as a real positive experience with something. So it's not like this sort of being pulled down by, you know, particular suspicion in one group or another, although obviously independents and Republicans are smaller, but it's it really does say that sort of, you know, perhaps people are, you know, confused about this issue. And, you know, when, you know, folks are asking questions, they're instantly suspicious of sort of kind of anything on this topic or you know, sort of for the FDA in general. Sorry, Carrie, Sarah, I feel like I cut you off there.
No, I was going to say that I think that is a good point, that probably, you know, FDA might not look at that and feel particularly thrilled. And, you know, I was covering a hearing in Congress yesterday related to COVID and vaccine safety. And it did strike me that listening to some of the members of Congress and some of the witnesses as well, that, like, I almost felt transported back to, I don't know, some point in 2020 or 2021. I mean, with some of the anti-vaccine comments, the skepticism of mRNA and the process those vaccines went through for development. There was a witness who was really promoting ivermectin and criticizing FDA for not permitting that, you know, for COVID, bringing up FDA's tweets around that topic. So it generally was coming from the Republican side of the aisle, those sorts of sentiments. Whereas you had Democrats who were trying to sort of push the conversation in a different direction and emphasize, you know, sort of comments or data around what the FDA approval process looks like, the types of trials that were done for the COVID vaccines, and those sort of things. So, you know, one thing I think also to consider when you think about this polling is, It didn't. Sometimes I know, like, I've seen polls where before they actually, like, ask people certain questions, they give them certain, like, background information because they don't necessarily assume they have, like, the full policy background. And at least this polling, you know, they didn't really do that necessarily. So you do sort of wonder, like, if you educate people right first about, oh, okay, this is how FDA approves drugs. This is what these are the sort of, like, the standard they have to meet to say something is, you know, safe and effective for the indication they're approving it for. Does that sort of shift people's understanding, right? Because you sort of, we're sitting in a sort of a special place here, right? Or, you know, maybe the people in our communities are quite well-versed in, you know, what FDA does, how they do it, what they're looking for before they, you know, clear, you know, a drug. And, you know, you also just sort of wonder, like, how much just certain gaps in the public's knowledge about what FDA does even, you know, shifts thinking, and again sort of leaves people, I don't know if vulnerable is the right word, but, you know, open to sort of being persuaded by, you know, people they politically identify with. And, you know, we've seen that be a big problem, you know, or a big thing that's been raised, I think, in the anti-vax, people who track kind of anti-vax sentiment is that they're very concerned that what's happening now and the trust, the distrust in science and, you know, public servants who do this sort of science-related policymaking, that it's becoming associated with political identity. That's seen as like a much more challenging thing to overcome, I guess, is once people tie those two things together, it's harder to break, I guess, the cycles of like misinformation and mistrust when you sort of build it into your political identity. So I think the segmentation by party and how the public views the FDA is probably, again, not the best sign. Like, you'd probably be happier, I think, as the FDA if you saw 65% trust, but it was like
evenly distributed. 70, yeah.
Right, more even, right, exactly. But the political, you know, ideology helping that divide makes it a little bit more concerning, I think. Again, it's, you know, because this poll in particular, you know, asked some sort of broader FDA questions, but was very abortion focused. That's obviously, you know, a much more divided political issue. So you do sort of wonder, you know, what if there was no mention of abortion in this poll and they were just saying the words cancer drug, would you have gotten the same results?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck by the same thing, that the data on the question of is mifepristone safe? And it was not like, I mean, it was the sentiment was disagreeing with the FDA decision, which was, yeah, that it is safe, benefits outweigh risks. And, you know, but yeah, it's, you know, if you said cancer drug, or you said rare disease drug, or, you know, something like that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you got different responses at all.
Yeah, the mifepristone question is, you know, very closely parallel to the FDA question. They didn't release the crosstab on Democrats, but it's sort of kind of lower overall, and Republicans are much lower. So as independents are a bit lower, I suspect. Democrats may be maybe a little lower too. That may be why they community left that one off. But we don't know. But you know, yeah, your opinion about the larger issue is often colored by your opinion about the particular one. So, you know, if they know they're talking about abortion, they may sort of kind of be more suspicious than if they're talking about, you know, can you trust the FDA to keep your cancer drug safe, or I suppose your cereal safe, or something like that. But you know, maybe given the baby formula stuff of late, maybe they shouldn't be asking that question if they want to get a good response. But,
the other thing I just wanted to bring up, and I think in some ways it's why this group did this polling and so forth, is there's been a lot of you know, since the Supreme Court ruling and Dobbs really shifted the abortion landscape throughout the country, there's been a lot of state-based, like, ballot initiatives, direct chances for people in states to vote on particular abortion protections or restrictions and so forth. And for the most part, even in very, very conservative Republican states, people have supported things that protect access to abortion. And so I think part of why they were doing this poll is to show, again, if you put these issues to the voters, you know, people are going to favor access. People don't think that their state should be allowed to, you know, ban this drug when FDA has approved it. And so I think that was some of their point, is that if this was a democratically, you know, voted on case, you know, that probably, you know, the status quo not quite the status quo, because again, we have there has been some complications because of some of these lawsuits and state measures since Dobbs, but, you know, the maybe pre-Dobbs but post-COVID access to the abortion pill would kind of remain. So I think that was also part of like the message they're trying to get across, is that there are places in the country where both judges and like legislatures and so forth are not in line with the sort of majority views on the topic.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see if there are some of those ballot initiatives in a presidential election year. Given how the parties are resorting, it feels like Democrats are doing better in off-cycle elections, just for given that the party is now sort of kind of more the party of college-educated voters who tend to vote in every election. If these ballot initiatives do come up during the presidential cycle, I think there are some efforts to get those on the ballot in places. It will be interesting to see sort of kind of how that voting turns out. But you're absolutely right, Sarah, that, if you could make the Supreme Court to kind of follow the polls, then abortion rights advocates would not have to worry about this case. But that's obviously sort of going to depend on more, the legal arguments and sort of kind of what, frankly, the Supreme Court wants to do. And, they'll justify it in the however they do, just like they have time immemorial in terms of sort of kind of just, there's enough ambiguity in any words in any legal documents that you can sort of kind of, get to the opinion that you want.
Well, you have to keep in mind too that the Supreme Court case is an administrative law issue. It's not necessarily, we don't like that mifepristone is available the way it is currently. I think if I'm understanding it correctly, they're arguing that the FDA didn't follow its regulations when they made the most recent change to the labeling or the REMS, whichever one it was. And so they're trying to get them to, go back on that. But there's big questions about setting a precedent for doing that, because you could, translate that to other things, but, to other, to approvals and so forth. But yeah, there's going to be all kinds of people trying to frame this argument coming up in various ways. And it's at the heart of it is an administrative issue, not necessarily a political one.
That's a great point, Derek. That's where kind of that this is where kind of why industry has where kind of after the initial Texas district court decision has sort of kind of become so involved in the case and is worried about sort of kind of what would happen sort of kind of the sanctity of FDA review. As I've noted, I feel that they're very concerned. As long as it's sort of kind of it's a one-way ratchet, they're not so worried about FDA's ability to pull a product expeditiously if they want to legal recourse. But it will be interesting to see sort of kind of if that broader implication is sort of kind of on the justice's mind as they weigh this case.
On that note, let's stay with the Supreme Court and talk about another oral argument that occurred. This one was on misinformation or a misinformation-related case. Sarah, back to you, since you wrote about this one too. What did the justices think of government fighting misinformation online?
I think the majority felt like the government should have some ability to communicate with internet platforms, I guess, that host content by, a variety of people, and to just basically like have some ability to share their opinion when they feel like, there is information on the platforms that is incorrect or, harmful to public health and so forth. Basically, at issue in this case is whether the government kind of going to, social media platforms like Facebook or Twitter, now X, Instagram or whatever, and saying, look, like we see there's all this like, anti-vaccine content on your website that's just, false and it's scientifically not true or blah, blah, blah. And, kind of nudging them, to maybe like do something about it to, not, promote the spread of misinformation, and that people have argued in this case that that's actually a First Amendment violation, because then when the companies, the social media platform sort of censor, otherwise, you know, take down some of this content, that they're sort of acting as like they sort of become the government and are actually violating First Amendment rights. There's also been some sort of legal history where, you know, the government, you know, they can't coerce you, you know, or really threaten you to do that. You know, that starts to become a First Amendment right. But here the government is arguing, you know, they weren't, you know, threatening. They weren't saying you have to do this. They weren't, they were, they're saying, we're not saying, you know, Twitter, I don't know, I just can't call it X. But, you know, they're not saying, you know, Facebook, if you don't do this, we're never gonna like, we're, you know, we're not gonna, you know, write this regulation the way you want it or something, you know. They're not using like threats and stuff. They're just sort of like saying like, look, we're just working in partnership with them to try and advance public health. And the majority of the Supreme Court justices basically seem to suggest, you know, if the people pushing for the government to really be limited and how it could communicate with these social media companies on these type of topics had their way, that basically, I think maybe Justice Jackson maybe said it best, you know, it would just hamstring the government to really do things that would protect the citizens of the country in various situations, not just, you know, around public health and misinformation, but around, you know, national security and, you know, foreign actors and election security and, you know, the ways we know the internet has been used sort of for wrong purposes. Now, again, there were a couple Supreme Court justices that seems maybe more sympathetic to the respondents in this case, but it also seems like they'd have to sort of be sympathetic to a variety of their arguments. And some of that is just whether they even like have standing to for the challenges they're making. And then you have to get to sort of the merits, as they say. And there's it seemed like this is not the even if I guess they want to be on this side of this very broad, expansive free speech argument that would basically curtail government speech in a lot of ways, I think. There were a lot of flaws pointed out with this case and the arguments. You know, I think Justice Kagan pointed out, you know, they didn't have enough proof to show, you know, in certain cases, like Facebook took stuff down because of what the government did versus just, you know, Facebook and Twitter and stuff had their own policies around, you know, handling some of this misinformation, and they were taking stuff down all the time on their own. And actually, if you look at sort of the, I think win-loss record maybe of the government is how they put it, you know, they weren't actually, you know, agreeing all the time. You know, it's not like they were just doing blindly everything the government was flagging for them. So, but anyway, that's, I think, a long way around to just say that while FDA actually sort of got dropped from this case as it moved up through the higher courts and the ruling sort of got narrowed, it just, I think it has come up in topics around like how Califf handles his misinformation campaign and what FDA maybe can or cannot do, or at least could do without raising some eyebrows among free speech advocates as it tries to push, you know, its agenda, which is, you know, they would say to just get the best and the most accurate information out there to the public on public health. But, you know, it just raises this issue that people are sort of very sensitive to the government looking like it's sort of censoring people, even if they're sort of saying we're trying to correct something that's wrong. You know, it becomes problematic for free speech absolutists.
Yeah, I have to say, like, one of the things I read, ironically, on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, while this argument was going on, was they were talking about the government nudging, and they were saying, I guess, I don't know if the conversation had gone to like, oh, the government doesn't do that in any other cases. And people who work in the White House and as a reporter covering FDA, I've had this happen to me. You get something, you talk to somebody over there and they say, I was told this, and they say, that's not correct. This is the right information. And, you know, is that a nudge? Is that censoring what somebody else said? Yeah, probably not, you know, but you know, it's like, if that's what they're doing, then, you know, and if it's something like, no, drinking Drano is not okay, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, then that, you know, that seemed like, in my mind, at least sensible for somebody to do, like, hey, you know, this is, we're trying to protect your health. We're not saying you can't complain or whatever about, you know, and talk about any issue you want to talk about. We're just saying, you know, if somebody, you believe this is true, we're telling you our evidence says that it's not. And so, you know, it's like that kind of, I think it's kind of comes down to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you find like government, and media interactions interesting. There were a lot of comments or chatter in the case that I found sort of amusing, you know, particularly people like, I mean, who were on the bench who had sort of longer careers in various government positions and maybe were in positions at different points in their career where they might have been sort of interacting with reporters or, you know, somehow, and they were talking about how, you know, there's a lot of, you know, back and forth that goes on between, you know, media reporters and, you know, various parts of the government agencies sort of saying like, you know, sometimes politely saying, you know, hey, Derek, you know, you wrote this story and, you know, we don't really think that's accurate or you misunderstood this and that. And sometimes it's, you know, of course, not anybody the Pink Sheet deals with, but, you know, sometimes it's, you know, somebody really calling from the government, whether it's a, you know, a congressional office or otherwise, kind of reaming reporters out and saying like, you don't know, you know, and just they were sort of there was a lot of hypotheticals in this case trying to test the waters of like what the ramifications would be. And right, some of that ranged from like how the press and the government would communicate to, again, like I said, you know, kind of like national security or security concerns or things that would protect children online. And, you know, what if somebody like doxed someone's account and was saying, you know, go to street address Y and, you know, do something harmful to this person. Like, could the government, you know, like could the FBI or, you know, some government agency that's like surveilling some of this stuff try and step in and nudge, you know, whatever social media platform to try and protect people. And actually, you know, that some of those hypotheticals struck me as most interesting since, you know, the Supreme Court has been a bit concerned about some of the judiciary, some of the judiciary's personal safety in relation to that. So maybe those, the concern about that rose. But yeah, there was definitely a lot of like concern that the widespread implications of what they were asking for here could really create some unintended consequences that the sense was most people might not want to actually play out.
I mean, the other thing to think, I guess I think about here is, you know, no matter what the decision is coming down, if it's, you know, even if they say no, you know, the case and they say the case doesn't have any merit, you wonder if it has just an ancillary impact on how FDA thinks about, you know, whatever it's online policies, you know, they've had a hard time kind of regulating promotion of drugs online. You know, I mean, we've talked about it on this podcast a lot. The issue with the vaccines and trying to get the right information out on vaccines, but even things like, you know, you should take drug X and you need a link to this page that has, you know, risks, you know, that has the side effects and so forth. And, you know, you wonder if this makes FDA maybe a little more gun shy because they don't want to, you know, trigger some kind of case or lawsuit or something and have this all litigated again and potentially lose, you know, even more authority. I mean, we've seen that with a lot of the promotional stuff where they just, you know, a lot of the warning letter count has just gone way down. And that's not entirely because of the legal ramifications of it, but there have been, you know, indications that a lot of the free, you know, First Amendment type of arguments are gaining more strength and they don't want to kind of put themselves in a position where they can't regulate any of it. So they kind of leave a lot of things alone.
Right. FDA really wants to have a very strong case. Oh, you can go ahead. I was just saying, right, with like the what's happened with FDA over the years with advertising regulation, right? It just seems like they really want to have a strong case to ensure that you're right, it doesn't open themselves up to some kind of free speech challenge that will then further hamper their authority.
Yeah, the I guess it would depend on how strong this decision is, you know, based on what you saw, Sarah. It sounds like it might be unanimous. There might be, you know, might be a 6-3 decision, perhaps. You know, it's always very hard to judge. So, sort of going to based on oral arguments, how someone's going to vote depends on sort of going to how the opinion is structured. But you know, if it is an unanimous case, then you know, FDA would have less to worry about in terms of sort of going to how they go about their anti-misinformation. Efforts. You know, one irony to me is that you know, as concerning as the you know, the plaintiffs make this out to be, the fact is that the amount of vaccine information that's out there is pretty substantial. It's not like you're kind of the government has kind of been terribly effective. That's sort of kind of what they're
yes.
what they're worried about. So we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah, it's real interesting stuff. So. Sarah, thanks for handling all the SCOTUS talk this week. Finally, we're going to look at the FDA's Oncology Drugs Advisory Committee. ODAC met March 14th and 15th to discuss three drugs proposed for treatment of various cancers. All the documents the agency put out in advance of the meeting were critical of the products, raising many questions about efficacy and safety. Yet the committee of outside experts voted that the benefits outweighed the risks for all three of the products. The FDA still could issue complete response letters for all of them, of course, but the outside opinion could go a long way to prevent that. In all three cases, committee members who were experts in the disease that was being discussed helped sway the committee to support the products. Now, I'm not saying this is unusual, but we thought it was really interesting nonetheless. So I'm curious, you know, Sarah, I know you were on one of the meetings. I was on one of the meetings. I covered one of the meetings. You know, was there what stuck out to you, you know, just in kind of watching this unfold?
I guess I was maybe struck by how it never seemed like the committee was leaning in FDA's direction, perhaps. That just it seemed like they had a pretty different, like, thought process maybe from the start. Something else that I guess stuck out for me a little bit was, like, a little bit of, like, different interpretation, and maybe at times FDA tried to steer them back. But so the product I looked at was J&J's CAR-T, and FDA was really concerned about a safety issue, and the committee sometimes was talking about the number of early deaths FDA was concerned about, and like a statistical way, like talking about statistical significance, and FDA kept trying to like go back to saying, like, you know, safety is not something where, you know, safety is always descriptive. It's not a statistical, you know, it's, you know, we're not thinking about whether it, you know, met some certain statistical significance in the way you're looking at your efficacy endpoint. So there were certain things where it seemed like FDA was like frustrated that the committee didn't quite like understand the agency's like regulatory parameters, I guess. Which was interesting, but I don't necessarily think FDA is going to like stand on those legs when it makes its decision, because I mean, ultimately it seemed like, at least, you know, in the drug I covered and as well as Sue's, I think the sense was like, and again, among the doctors who really care for these patients, and, you know, that people acknowledge and are aware of these initial sort of safety risks, and that some percentage of people who try to get this treatment, just because of sort of the difficult, you know, processes you have to go through to get it, may suffer some bad adverse events or and die. But that if you succeed in, you know, successfully getting it, that your quality of life and seems like your overall time alive may be, you know, much improved. And they seem to think that was, you know, given this disease and everything else about it, that was an acceptable risk, or it's particularly, again, if patients are appropriately kind of warned and counseled about it.
Yeah, it's I covered the consideration of imetelstat, which is for anemia caused by myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a kind of cancer. And I actually had the opposite experience of you, Sarah, because FDA gave a really negative pre-briefing document, and the committee was thinking about it and chewed on it for a while. And then when they got to their discussion part, they said, the chairman said, can we have the experts in MSA tell us, you know, what they think of this? And they both said resoundingly, this drug is good. We need this. It works. Patients want this. This is, you know, I would use this. And so the idea is, yeah, with MSA patients have their I guess they have a lot of that they have to get a lot of blood transfusions for the anemia that they experience, and this drug is supposedly could create what's called transfusion independence, which is a significant amount of days where you don't have to, you know, it's a measure of days where you don't need a transfusion and so forth. I'm butchering the definition, but it's, you know, like that. And, you know, being able to put them the patients on like a regular schedule, you know, they said was really important for quality of life. And, you know, you can take vacations and you can plan things and all these other, you know, things instead of being constantly chained to going to the hospital. And if you happen to live 6 hours away from the medical center where you have to go get your transfusion, which is the case for a lot of these patients, you can plan for that instead of, you know, getting up one morning and saying, oh, I have to go get a transfusion because of whatever, you know, whatever reason. So, yeah, it was I thought it was really interesting that they went from FDA questioning efficacy, FDA questioning safety, FDA questioning statistical analyses. They were even questioning whether the results were applicable to the U.S. population because most of the trial participants were in Europe. I mean, it was if you could think of the number of questions that you could come up with, that the FDA had them all pretty much. And the fact that the practitioners looked at the same data that FDA looked at and came up with the exact opposite, essentially the opposite interpretation of it, I thought, you know, I thought was really, really interesting.
That's why I have the advisory committee, I guess. If as we've noted through kind of it's oftentimes that OCE brings a an application before the ODAC to sort of kind of send a message to other sponsors, but in this case, I guess the message was sent to FDA on what to do with this data. We'll see how it works out, but it's always sort of interesting that sort of kind of the you know, predicting the outcome based on the briefing documents is an imperfect science. So.
Yeah, I think
these briefing documents were kind of the classic briefing documents. They were not the point counterpoint that OCE has been moving towards over the last few years. I don't know if that's kind of played a role in things or not.
Yeah, I think with the day the imetelstat briefing documents came out, Geron, the company that's sponsoring it, their stock plummeted. And then 2 days later, when the advisory committee voted, it jumped way back up again. So, predict based on the documents at your peril.
Yes. And predict the approval decision based on the advisory committee also at your peril, although I think a stronger correspondence there.
Another thing that we noticed that our colleague Sue Sutter noticed when she was writing the piece was that the chairman of ODAC, Ravi Madan, was acting more like a facilitator than necessarily a consensus builder, which is, you know, again, not unusual, but also kind of interesting because there had been some talk about wanting to kind of change the role, or at least adjust the role of the committee chairman a little bit. He was the one in my meeting that opened the discussion with, I want to hear what the practitioners and the experts have to say about this. And then that kind of set the tone for the rest of the discussion and eventually the vote. You know, and we've seen, Sarah, Matt, I'm sure we've all seen meetings where the chairman kind of, you know, will cut people off and try and steer conversations one way or the other and you know, say, no, we're not going to talk about that. And if, you know, if the sponsor's trying to chime in with rebuttals, they'll say, no, we're not going to listen to that right now. And, you know, they have their own ways of kind of being able to kind of steer things how they want them. They want them to go either consciously or subconsciously. So yeah, that was another, I think, thing that I thought was interesting about this.
Yeah, it was, it's definitely felt a lot different watching the chairperson sort of, right, try and pull people into the conversation and pull specific people into the conversation like that, compared to the, what I'm used to watching, which is, you know, the people who are most eager to speak. And sometimes, yes. You know, you get a few people who dominate the conversation and other people who you don't even like hear from into the vote, or something like that. So, it was interesting, I guess I didn't appreciate until Sue wrote about this, that this is something sort of FDA maybe has sort of asked or directed them to do, because I was wondering if it was like a particular committee chair just sort of taking their prerogative to almost steer the committee in a certain direction. So at first I was a little bit confused or taken aback. So it was actually interesting for me to learn that this was something FDA sort of was encouraging.
And, you know, to a certain extent too, for, you know, the sponsors who are listening to us, I mean, it's something for them to pay attention to as well, just because, you know, as you're planning your advisory committee, you know, your advisory committee approach, if you know the chair is going to act a certain way, or you can kind of predict that, then that's going to change your strategy in terms of how you speak and what you speak about and maybe the questions you ask and so forth, the whole approach to the meeting. So if this kind of catches on and other advisory committees, you know, kind of take the same approach, it could be a, you know, something for, you know, for sponsors to really take, you know, pay attention to.
I was going to say another thing Sue pointed out was that they had in our advisory committee, because it was like a back-to-back CAR T day, they had an FDA sort of guest speaker who basically just sort of gave the lay of the land of the treatment options and how, you know, the lines of treatment typically progress in the this diseased, and FDA was pretty clear with the committee too that they could ask this person questions, but they were making sure they weren't asking that person questions to sort of like ask them what they thought about the application, right? It was just to kind of get everybody on the same playing field, which that's something a bit new and different, and, you know, seen as sort of having like almost a sort of semi-neutral party kind of put everybody on the same page, which is a unique way of doing things.
ODAC is ever the trendsetter. Well, thanks everyone for the great discussion. That's all for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Sarah Carlin Smith and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.